Support for this episode comes from Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company, who have proudly provided California attorneys with specialized professional liability coverage for over 45 years. And did you know? Lawyers Mutual offers competitive specialty rates for their members who act as a neutral, either on a full-time or part-time basis. So, as part of their arbitration mediation specialty program, all members receive an individualized premium based on the areas of practice their firm handles. This allows Lawyers Mutual to adjust rates annually, and as you build your mediation practice, your premium will reflect the portion of your time spent working as a neutral. To learn more about how this great program can benefit your firm, visit lawyersmutual.com today.
Welcome to the audio edition of BHBA's Mediation Training. In this episode, your host, the Honorable Gail S. Toussaint of JAMS, will introduce you to dispute resolution. Let's dive in.
I'd like to welcome everyone to Introduction to Dispute Resolution. This is part of a program sponsored by the Beverly Hills Bar Association Mediation Certification Program. And we appreciate that there are going to be probably several recordings that you're going to review as part of the requirements for completion of the program. I was happy to be invited by the Beverly Hills Bar Association to participate as part of its volunteer faculty and look forward to introducing you to dispute resolution. So I have had a connection, I would say, to ADR for most of my legal career. I actually am from the California area and am delighted to have this connection with what I understand to be a very special bar association in terms of its history. I attended UCLA undergrad and for part of law school, and so I do have a connection to California, even though most of my legal career has been in the state of Georgia. As you can see from the slide, I had the opportunity to help found one of our bar associations, the Georgia Association of Black Women Attorneys, now over 40 years ago. The organization is still very strong and vibrant in serving the legal community. I have spent most of my career on the bench as a trial judge for the Atlanta Judicial Circuit, and served as its chief judge, as well as serving as the chair of the Fulton County ADR Board. So in this course, what we're aiming to do is to give you an overview of alternative dispute resolution, which we all know we refer to as ADR. We do have some objectives. We want you to be able to understand why there is a need for ADR and how it came about, and to have a general understanding of the different types of alternative dispute resolution that you may encounter as a practicing attorney or as part of your studies if you're still in law school. We do understand, I think there's a mutual understanding that your attendance throughout the entirety of the recorded session is required. And I hope that you will enjoy, as I have, a career involving ADR. So let's discuss a little bit, learn a little bit together about the history of dispute resolution. So ADR has an interesting past. It has become an industry with standards and associations that began back in 1906 with what is referred to as the first Pound Conference, which is interesting because the reference first Pound Conference actually doesn't refer to a conference. It refers to a speech or an address that was made by Roscoe Pound when he was relatively young, just about 36 years old, and he was speaking at the 29th American Bar Association conference, which was being held in St. Paul. He was a University of Nebraska law professor, and he wanted to cause maybe an uproar, but had some concerns about the justice system and how it was operating and whether or not it was addressing the needs of the average citizen and the businesses and entities that find themselves interacting with the legal system. There's a very interesting article I'd like to refer you to. It's in the Cardoza Journal of Conflict Resolution, Volume 18, an article written by Laura Triam and Brian Farkas that gives you a very extensive history of ADR. So Mr. Pound, as he was giving his address, urged everyone to explore the dichotomy between everyone deserving their day in court, something that we hear often, and the general public's dissatisfaction with the traditional legal system. And I found this to be kind of interesting in that the reasons that he identified for persons' dissatisfaction with our traditional justice system then, back in 1906, continue in many ways to be present-day dissatisfactions. The rigidity of the system, all of the rules, and the perception that if you're not familiar with the rules or if you're not able to use the rules with ease, that your ability to have your fair day in court may in fact be compromised. The emphasis he spoke of that is placed on the procedure, placed above the human experience and the quest for justice. And then finally, he also highlighted the fact that there is perhaps a distaste by the common person for the sport of litigation. And by that, he was speaking of whether you engage in certain practices or use the rules to your benefit, you know, for the win, for the ultimate prize, as opposed to trying to distill the facts, determine the truth, and reach justice at the end of the day. So 70 years later, after the first Pound Conference, there was a second Pound Conference. And this was an actual conference that was focused on understanding and discussing dissatisfactions with our justice system. It was convened by then Chief Justice Warren Burger, who we know devoted his career to improving the legal and judicial systems that we are all a part of. It was intended to commission a task force that was created. So 70 years after the first address by Roscoe Pound, Chief Justice Burger convened a conference devoted to the discussion of ADR in our justice system. And he proposed a courthouse of the future where various disputes would be categorized such that some would be litigated, the bigger cases in controversy, the higher amounts in controversy, and the more routine, non-adversarial disputes would not be resolved in the courthouse, but would go through the ADR process. So the second Pound Conference, as I referenced, created a task force that worked after the convening of a conference, and it produced a 35-page report. You can imagine it was filled with all kinds of recommendations and findings and truisms and not, perhaps. But there were three main recommendations, and those recommendations fueled the ADR model that pushed forward after the conference. The first recommendation was that there should be neighborhood justice centers. And I feel very fortunate here in the Atlanta area that we still have one of those first neighborhood justice centers. It's now called the Justice Center of Atlanta. And we attribute its success to the career devoted to this topic and the pursuit of this form of resolving disputes to Edie Prem. She helped with founding ours. He also, the task force recommended that there be compulsory arbitration of certain disputes, especially those that were less than $10,000 in controversy. And I recall as a younger lawyer that we had a new rule in the Atlanta Judicial Circuit that focused on compulsory, mandatory arbitration for smaller disputes. And we had small panels of attorneys who volunteered their time to sit as arbitration panels and resolve those disputes for the litigants. And then the final recommendation, as mentioned, was that the non-adversarial smaller disputes would not even be resolved in the courthouse. Rather, they would be resolved through the work of our neighborhood justice centers. So it is really very interesting to kind of focus then on the impact that the Pound Conference has had on current day ADR. We know that there are various mandates for a multi-door judicial approach, meaning that our courthouses are operated in a manner that provides different vehicles to resolve different types of disputes. For instance, you may have a landlord and tenant court that requires the participants to first try to resolve the issues that arise between landlord and tenant in a manner that is akin to a mediation or a conference, more so than actually having a hearing, where oftentimes, especially as we see on television, the small person, not the big landlord, doesn't even have a clue as to how to present their case to court in order to expect to get a fair result. There are a variety of statutes and regulations that govern such a multi-door judicial approach. And I certainly would suggest that if you're going to practice in this area, that you need to be familiar with all those rules, not just the typical rules that govern litigation, such as the Civil Practice Act or the Evidence Code, but you need to know the rules that govern the ADR in your jurisdiction. There have been many statements of endorsement of this pathway for specific types of disputes. I mentioned landlord-tenant. You have labor and employment. You may have this in your family law area. I know in our court, we have a whole family law division that is devoted just to resolving divorce, custody, property, division type issues in a non-adversarial way, where you meet first with the court, with judicial officers who help you sift through discovery and help you to resolve issues by sending you to mediation as opposed to getting geared up for an adversarial hearing. There's been tremendous progress in the education provided by our law schools that are encouraging students to become certified and skilled in conducting mediations, to be prepared if ordered to go into a mandatory arbitration. So that's good, so that this is no longer considered to be novel or frowned upon, but in fact is encouraged as a great way to get cases resolved in a less expensive and more efficient way. And we definitely see now through the legal industry's commitment to ADR that we have community mediation centers. You have private mediation companies such as JAMS. That's the company that I'm affiliated with. Oftentimes, there will be mandatory arbitration clauses in contracts that govern employment or consumer construction, other types of controversies that require you to go through ADR before you even file in court. So that's something to look for when you take on a case, whether or not you first have to engage in some form of ADR before you prepare a complaint to file in court. And then we have public-funded ADR services, such as court-sponsored settlement conferences. For instance, the California Dispute Resolution Program Act funded funds mediation services for cases that are filed in Superior and other courts in the state of California. So we've talked a little bit, for some, it may have been too much on the history of ADR. And once again, I encourage you to, you know, if you're interested, to consider the Bar Journal article that I referenced, as well as there's lots of literature out there. But now we want to help you to understand dispute resolution proceedings. So there are three primary forms of ADR. Mediation, and I chuckle at that only because when I often refer or tell someone that I am preparing for, or I can't take a call because I'm in a mediation, they often think I'm saying meditation. So we'll have to reinforce for those that are not familiar with this, that the word is mediation. Then we have arbitration, and we also have settlement conferences. And I think it would be helpful for us to talk about each, things that they have in common as well as differences. And so this slide highlights, I think this is an important slide, some of the common ADR processes that we've spoken about and the key differences. So first, I think it's good to know that mediation and settlement conferences, at least in my experience, are typically utilized at multiple phases of trying to resolve a controversy. So you may have more than one mediation take place before a case is resolved. You may have more than one effort, if the case has been filed in court, more than one effort by the judge to try to get the parties to actually settle the case. And that's a little different than the timing of an arbitration, because as mentioned earlier, oftentimes you'll have mandatory arbitration clauses in a contract that require you to engage in arbitration prior to your going to court. And what I have seen, you maybe have also had this experience, is that someone maybe hasn't read the contract that gives rise to the dispute as carefully as they should have, or perhaps skipped over the arbitration clause. And then what often happens is if the case has already been filed in court, then you have a motion to stay or a motion to dismiss because the opposing party, did not honor the commitment that was made by agreement when they signed the contract to use arbitration as the method of trying to resolve the dispute. Neutrals, those would be the professionals that are helping to resolve the case. So the neutral is not one of the parties. The neutral is not the attorney that has been hired by one or both of the parties. The neutral is the role that I assume And presumably you might be assuming if you become certified and decide to start a mediation or an arbitration practice. And so it's really important to talk a little bit about our role in this process. Typically, we, the neutrals, are licensed attorneys. In many instances, they also can be judges, such as myself, that have either taken senior status or have retired. And the role that we play is that we're impartial. So whether you're an attorney or a judge, or in some instances, neutrals maybe just have an expertise in a particular area and may not be members of a bar. For instance, there are many mediators who once were insurance adjusters, and they bring that expertise to the process of trying to resolve the case because they have an expertise in terms of evaluating claims, knowing the pitfalls of resolution, et cetera. But as stated, the point or the role of the neutral is to facilitate an outcome. And that is the role in a mediation or a settlement conference. You are facilitating the parties themselves coming to their own agreement as to how to resolve the case. However, if you are the neutral in an arbitration, you are taking a role that is more akin to that of a judge, because you are ultimately, whether you are a single sole arbitrator or whether you're serving on a panel of arbitrators, the arbitrator in this instance makes the decision for the parties. The parties present their evidence to the arbitrator, and the arbitrator makes a decision. Whereas in a mediation or a settlement conference, the parties present information for purposes of basically kind of a show and tell with each other and to help the neutral facilitate an outcome. Preparation is definitely key. And so I urge you, whether you're the neutral or whether you are the party or whether you are the advocate on behalf of the party, preparation should not be underestimated. You definitely need to prepare. You want to be familiar with the facts of the case. You want to have engaged in some discovery. You want to be familiar and comfortable with presenting and showing and explaining exhibits. You definitely need to know, as part of your preparation, the weaknesses of your case, the strengths of your case. You definitely should not overlook the applicable law, because you're not doing this in a vacuum. You're doing it in the context of what is the alternative if you don't resolve the case in a mediation or a settlement conference or in an arbitration, and you ultimately go to court, the judge, the jury, whoever is deciding the case in that instance, in that alternative, will be applying the law. The preparation is slightly different, though, for each form of ADR. If you're in a mediation, your preparation should be focusing on and including what does each party or client want. You're representing a party going to a mediation. What is it that they want as the outcome at the end of the mediation? What are they willing to accept? How are they willing to compromise? What points are more important than others? Are they looking for money? Are they looking for respect? Are they looking for an apology? All of these things are things that you need to know as the attorney mediating, as well as knowing as the neutral, so that you can facilitate an outcome. In an arbitration, your preparation is also very important, slightly different. You need to know, what does the arbitration agreement provide for? What are the limits? What are the exclusions? What law has been chosen to apply into what aspect of your case? All of that will bear on the outcome. And finally, if you're preparing for a settlement conference, You need to be able to leverage the judge's perspective to evaluate your position versus the opposing party's position and to arrive at the best alternative to an adversary hearing. And there's no one better to help you to do that than the judge. So use the judge as an ally as opposed to someone who is trying to keep you from getting the case resolved. Are there pending motions that might affect the party's willingness to compromise? And that's a great segue to our next slide. So when you look at this chart, this gives you an overall picture of where ADR fits into a traditional approach by the judicial system to resolve the case. So you have pre-litigation resolution attempts through mediation. Long before you file the complaint, it is possible to reach out to the other side and suggest a mediation. These can be very effective if the parties are candid and straightforward with the issues. They're not holding back. But you can try it at the beginning. If it's not successful, then you can proceed with initiating your case through the filing of a complaint. And then you review the answer, get a little bit more information there. It's a little more formal because now it has been put in a pleading and the parties are going to be held accountable for what has been stated in their complaint, their petition, or in their response. Typically, in this day and age, it really would be unusual not to be required to participate in case management and to have a conference pretty early on in your case. And at that point, the form of ADR selected or suggested can be discussed. You can request, perhaps, if you have a reluctant party to participate, you can request the court to order your party and the other side to some type of ADR. But again, the conferences may not resolve. They may reveal information, but may not necessarily resolve the case. And so you proceed into your initial discovery phase. And this, again, is an opportunity with the exchange of information to say, hey, okay, I see these key documents. I see yours. You see mine. Why don't we make another effort to try to get the case resolved? You can go to a private entity. You most likely will have an opportunity, maybe once, usually not more than twice, to use the court services for this purpose. You get your discovery completed or nearly discovered, completed. You can attempt again if you haven't yet. Then you get into the dispositive motion. So if one party has filed a motion for summary judgment or a motion to dismiss, then it may be a little more difficult to get everyone to the table for purposes of a mediation because they want to see who's going to win the motion. So you need to be aware of that and bring that to the court's attention to find out if the court is going to rule promptly, or is the court instead inclined to wait and give you another opportunity to try to resolve it on your own? You go through the whole process, as you can see here from the diagram, and then it's time for trial. And as we all know, how many cases actually get resolved when the jury is waiting to be seated? Maybe you've already gone through voir dire jury selection. And then the other side says, hey, you want to step outside and discuss this one more time? Never say no. Of course, every opportunity is the perfect opportunity to try to resolve your case. So you may have a final status conference where the court insists that you do so, or you may decide to do this on your own. And even after you go to trial and you get your jury verdict, or it's a bench trial and the judge rules on your motions, rules on your case, after deciding what the facts are, you still may have an opportunity and should employ it for purposes of trying to resolve the case before you expend additional funds and take the case up on appeal. So this slide helps us to kind of understand the differences in the goals of the judicial system versus ADR. As we can see in ADR, we're trying to get the parties to be, to own up or to be invested in the outcome. Oftentimes, litigants are super focused on having their day in court. They want to be heard. They want to prove the other side to be right. I mean, the other side to be wrong and that they're right. They want to see their attorney turn the opposing party or a particular witness, into mincemeat through a vigorous cross-examination. But at the end of the day, the time and the effort, the emotional strain and toil through going through an adversary proceeding, all of us know is a lot. And that's where, ADR is focused on trying to preserve relationships between the parties. Is there a way to work through the controversy such that the parties perhaps can still have some type of relationship that they value going forward while getting the particular controversy resolved? There is a tremendous potential through ADR for being more creative in how the evidence is reviewed, for how it's considered, for coming up with outcomes that are specific to each case and the litigants involved, and not having to be as focused or concerned with any mandatory procedures or rules and regulations and trying to get the parties to reach a mutually acceptable resolution. When you think of our traditional justice system, it's focused on adjudicating rights and responsibilities. So you have a winner, you have a loser. You do try to give everyone their day in court. There needs to be due process, making sure that the process is fair, making sure that the playing field, we've heard this often, is as level as possible. And also, though, we need to be honest, candid, and acknowledge that the judicial system, the judges, the court personnel, we're all focused on also trying to get our case clearance rates as low as possible. We need to work through the cases. There are too many cases to try. And often you may end up with not having sufficient time to devote to a particular case, which is another good reason to consider resolving it in an alternative way. I will say that we as neutrals and as practicing attorneys in this area, we play a huge role in getting our clients and the parties to understand the value of ADR because they're not going to necessarily get it on their own. And they may be suspect, quite frankly, of us as the advocates, if instead of jumping up and down on the table and tearing into a witness, we're suggesting what may feel more like a conference or an informal meeting. So we have to let them know why we're doing this. In terms of the process and the procedure, I think as we have already stated, ADR is very flexible. It's informal, and it's definitely intended to be confidential. So you have the advantage of the parties being able to share information, concede positions, and express themselves in a way that they may be far less comfortable doing in a public courtroom. ADR is intended to be faster. I have found, and I would caution those that are watching, that those of us that have litigated probably come to this with a mindset of, you know, what we're accustomed to doing in terms of the rules, in terms of pretrial preparation, discovery, interrogatories, document requests, lengthy depositions. All of those procedures are generally not favored in ADR because we're trying to get the parties to resolve their dispute without expending all that time and energy. That's not to say that there may not be some minimal discovery. Of course, there will be. But typically, it's a far, far fewer number of document requests and interrogatories that you might otherwise be accustomed to. It may be a deposition of one or two witnesses. It's several, certainly not intended to be several, and for each deposition to go on for hours or days. And for that reason, it is more cost effective. And, you know, this slide shows the opposite of all of that in our traditional justice system. So now we're going to talk a little bit about the relationship between ADR and our traditional justice system. So as we mentioned earlier, ADR has come to be endorsed, favored by the judiciary as a means to provide resolution and to also save resources for courts and litigants. For courts, certainly, probably all courts, feel that they're overwhelmed by the number of cases that are filed on a daily basis, certainly on an annual basis. And the years that we have just completed in terms of the COVID pandemic and the effect that it had on being able to resolve disputes in a traditional way has only exasperated the dockets and the backlogs. ADR, for that reason, was a lifesaver throughout the time when emergency orders had courthouses either closed or reduced hours or only emergencies being conducted in person. And ADR is a way to kind of off-ramp many of the cases that otherwise would just be sitting, you know, waiting for a day or a week to be assigned for resolution by trial or by lengthy hearing. You can select certain issues in a case and focus on those through ADR. As already stated, it can be used as a pretrial, a post-trial option, and in many instances is a first step before litigation is initiated. We have referenced binding and non-binding ADR only slightly, so I want to spend a few minutes on that at this time. A binding mediation or binding arbitration would mean that the parties know going into the process that whatever their result is, assuming that there is a decision made or an agreement reached, that you're not going to be able to wiggle out of it or change your mind afterwards. This typically would apply more so to an arbitration, I would think, than a mediation. But the difference between it being binding and non-binding means just that, that you're going to be stuck with or blessed with, depending on your viewpoint of the outcome of the session that has been conducted outside of the traditional system. The obvious negatives to that are that you don't know what the outcome is going to be, but
there are far more benefits to going through this, in that you actually do have a decision that the parties have come to an agreement on, as opposed to a judge or jury telling the parties that this is what the outcome is going to be. An example would be, if this is a divorce matter, and you have issues of child support or alimony or how property is going to be divided, it's far better for the parties to talk about it, argue about it if they will, but come to a compromise and agree, okay, we can live with this, than being told by someone else who doesn't have an interest, especially if you're talking about a jury, in your private lives, to tell you what the outcome is going to be. There's some instances where, as a settlement tool, the judge may offer the opportunity to have a summary jury trial, where the party present evidence in a summary way to a jury, an advisory jury, and they consider the evidence. They can engage in questions and come up with an outcome that will help the parties evaluate their case. And they can decide, again, whether or not, in using creative tools, settlement tools such as this, whether or not they want them to be binding or not. So as the neutral, your influence, if we will, maybe on facilitating the parties to reach an agreement, may be impacted by where the case or where the controversy is, if in fact litigation has already or is contemplated or has already been initiated. So you potentially can have the most influence on a case not coming to the courthouse for resolution if you are handling a pre-litigation mediation. And in order, though, to have the influence that ideally you would want as a successful mediator, you would probably need to be particularly informed about the type of case, the likely outcome of those types of cases in your jurisdiction. So in other words, the parties will not have already gone through the process of developing their case in terms of the normal pretrial preparation through motions and discovery. They'll just know that, there's a claim that something has happened, and whatever the kind of initial response to it is by the party who's being charged with having breached a duty or caused an injury, et cetera. So there definitely is a space, I would say, here before the case is filed, for a good outcome that would reduce all of the expense and the emotional strain caused by going through litigation. Once the discovery has been initiated, there is potential there also for trying to resolve, to get the case resolved. How many times have we heard, now that I've seen the responses to the interrogatories, I need to take 10 depositions and get all this information from third parties that may be very difficult. And so there is an opportunity to, again, suggest to the parties to kind of lead them to an outcome that will simplify the resolution without having to go through all of that fact-finding. Oftentimes, I will get a call from parties who are asking me to mediate because the court has imposed a period of time within which they need to conduct a mediation. And so in that instance, I would say the neutral is especially empowered with the ability to try to facilitate a resolution, because you know that you can say, well, Judge Jones says that, you know, you need to mediate this case within 30 days. And so we need to pick a date. We, you know, we can't dilly-dally about the calendar. We need to find a time, get together, and make this work. And the beauty of going back to the pandemic in an earlier part of the session, one of the beauties of it is that we now know that we can conduct ADR with ease and effectively virtually. So it no longer should be an excuse about someone being out of town or unable to come and meet in person, because we can do this using Zoom or Teams or any other virtual platform that might be suggested. So basically, don't need to go through the whole slide, but the point is that at different parts of the process, you as the neutral will have an opportunity to help the parties resolve their dispute. So now we need to talk just a little bit more about, you know, what is the role and what are the responsibilities of neutrals? We obviously know that that you are to be neutral, hence our name. And that shouldn't be hard, but because the process is much more informal than when you are in court in a hearing. And for those of us who once wore the black robe, there is a transition in understanding now that you still have authority with the parties, but you're there because they have selected you, not because they have to be in your courtroom because your case was assigned to you. And so you have to be very careful to make sure that you continue to display your ability to be neutral and your impartiality, your being impartial. The most best practices that I have reviewed definitely require you to go over all of this with the parties, even if their attorneys have already done so, because what's most important is for the parties, the people that you are meeting for the first time, and you have to gain their trust with you as well as the process. They need to understand, well, what are the rules that govern my having to interact with you? So you are to maintain their confidentiality. If they share anything with you in perhaps a caucus, in a session where it's just you and them and their advocate, and then you're going to leave their room and go to the other room, you need to make sure that you know that you have their permission to share any information. Generally, it's considered to be confidential unless they tell you you have permission to share any information. And then there are various standards of ethics that you need to make sure you review and that you understand, so that there are no conflicts or any other breaches of ethical conduct by you as the neutral. So I like to call these our ideal responsibilities. We certainly should aspire to meet and exceed all of these. And I think it's important to spend a little bit of time on this. So the context again is that you have been selected by the parties, most likely, or randomly assigned if this is a court annexed mediation situation. And you have to set the tone for communication. What are you going to permit, I guess, to be the tone of parties speaking to each other, advocates speaking to each other? It's less about how they're addressing you. It's far less formal than it would be if you were a judge in a court proceeding, but you need to set the tone for communication. You need to determine early on in your session as to what are the goals. You know, why are we here? What is it that you would like to tackle first? So if it's the type of case that has several potential sub resolutions to be achieved, then what order do we want to go in? So as the next point says, determining the issues and potential pain points. One thing that I have always found to be very helpful as a mediator is to meet with the advocates, the attorneys, if there are attorneys involved, for each side separately prior to the actual mediation session. And that gives you an opportunity to get a whole lot of information directly from the attorney outside of the presence of their client. So they would be able to express to you and inform you of perhaps topics to be avoided or topics that are going to be emotional, topics that are going to trigger responses from the parties and prepare you so that you can receive the information but not react in a way that may appear not to be partial or that you're being judgmental. You want to make sure that they understand the process. So you go over the rules, whether or not it's confidential, that you're not going to be a witness in their case, that you're not going to run and tell the other side things that they ask you not to, that you're not going to be communicating about them with the assigned judge. All of these things are important for them to understand before you start the process officially. So usually this would be covered in an opening session. And it's up to you and the dynamic between the parties as to whether or not you're going to do this with everyone in the same session, in the same room, around the same table, or whether you're going to do it in effect twice, explaining to each side but separately. It is your job or responsibility to give the parties suggestions for things that they may consider in order to resolve the case. You're not going to just say, well, this is what you should do, but you certainly are in a position to share with them some suggestions, to ask them some probing questions that may cause them to consider or reconsider a position. You are definitely guiding the negotiations. It is not your role, and you are underserving the parties if you're merely carrying a piece of paper back and forth with numbers on it. You're not to be merely a messenger. You are bringing to the table, they are paying you as the neutral for your experience. So you need to share the experience in productive ways. You need to help them to reach agreements. You need to be able to monitor the room and whether or not they need to take breaks, whether or not there needs to be a step back, assessing, are you making progress, and keeping them engaged in the process. All of these are ideal attributes of a good mediator. So having shared all that I have with you, and I hope that you have some good takeaways from the slides and the presentation, it is not always the case that you're going to be in a situation in a mediation or an arbitration or a settlement conference with parties, both of whom have attorneys. Oftentimes, you will have what's referred to as a pro per, a self-represented party, a pro se party, and that requires you as the neutral to approach the process very carefully. We just, went over the importance of the parties understanding the process. You need to make sure that you have taken the time to understand their position. There are any number of reasons why they may be there without an attorney. They may have started with an attorney. The attorney may have not been able to serve them well and actually, dump them as the client. It could be that it is a problem, difficult party who cannot get along with his or her attorney, or maybe feels that they know better than the attorney and they're unable to take advice. It may be a matter of finances, not being able to find an attorney that's willing to take the case that the party can afford. So there are any number of reasons why the person may be there without an attorney. And it is absolutely part of being fair and impartial and neutral not to make a judgment, an adverse judgment about them or their case as a result of their not having an attorney. So you need to make sure that you are able to break down the rules such as they are, the process, the value of going through this, why it's not a waste of their time, in a way that they can communicate. And so your initial interaction, the first several minutes of the session will be important for you to gain their confidence in your ability to help them to resolve their case. There will be challenges. It's certainly not easier if one party does not have an attorney. It may be easier if both parties don't have an attorney, but that doesn't mean that it's going to be an easy mediation, because then what you have to do is to listen especially well to both sides and to be able to summarize and regurgitate and repeat back what is being said in a way that you understand, as well as a way that may be helpful to the other side. And ultimately, that will cause the party that you're speaking for, but facilitating what they're trying to communicate in a way that they say, oh, okay, yes, this person gets what I'm trying to say. I think I can do this, and I'm willing to spend time. And so I would say that it does take a lot of patience. I think mostly it's a matter of listening very carefully and giving each side the opportunity probably to vent more than you may wish to hear, but it's important for them to be able to share what they have to share, especially if they've been ordered to come and do this with you, as opposed to presenting their case, directly in court, as perhaps they had originally planned. I have enjoyed mediations with pro per parties, and find that most often, if you communicate to the attorney, if there's an attorney involved on the other side, that you're not planning to be unfair to their client who's paying them to be there, oftentimes the professionalism that is exhibited is quite rewarding as they try to assist you in making sure that the other side without the attorney understands the process. If there are not attorneys involved, most likely you should contemplate as the neutral, not merely facilitating an agreement, but guess what? Actually writing out the agreement, because the pro per parties are most likely not going to be equipped to put in writing what has been agreed to in a way that will be acceptable by the court if the case was assigned to you by a judge. So in that instance, it's very important for you to start developing kind of a form file of basic agreements that you can fill in the blanks as specific cases come before you. So it looks like we've come to the end of this session. I'm not sure what order this will appear in, but it has been my absolute pleasure to share with you my views and experience as a mediator, as well as a trial judge. I truly believe in the value of ADR at any point along the way. It was very rare when I would say, no, it's too late for you to try to settle the case on your own. We certainly have time constraints on a published calendar, but I always encouraged parties and their attorneys to try to work out the cases on their own, because ultimately, as I've said before, when you are invested in the outcome based on what you have been willing to give up and compromise, you're most likely going to be less inclined to end up back in court because on a contempt for failing to abide by what you have agreed to. Contempts usually arise when the parties didn't have control over the outcome and they feel that they have the inability to comply, or they still do not have the will or willingness to comply with what they've been ordered to do against their wishes. So good luck to all of you. Mediation, arbitration, settlement conferences, three important aspects of ADR. And it's a really enjoyable career path that I have ended up on. I enjoy being able to kind of roll up the sleeves and help parties reach resolutions outside of the courthouse. So I think you will as well. Thank you.
You may be eligible for CLE credit in your state. Visit bhba.org/podcasts for more information.